Hi, everybody.
Hi, Grace.
I am Grace Snyder, and by the grace of God, I am a happy, recovered alcoholic. I'm delighted to be here with you beautiful people tonight and to share with Frank and June and Marge and all of you beautiful people to share Raphael's birthday. We met Raphael 5 or 6 years ago at Del Mar at the convention. And it was just a joy to meet that boy. I'll never forget what Raphael said. He said, Clarence, may I just carry your bags up to your room? He said, I'd be so honored. I don't think I'll ever forget that young man. I'm sorry to know that he's ill tonight. We do plan to see him and take a tape to him while we're here. I don't know if anybody has ever had to do what I have to do a lot of these days, and that's talk before Clarence Snyder. The only thing I wouldn't do is talk after him. I don't have much history to go into to tell you, except I'll start on March the 4th of 1968. I had moved to Jacksonville, Florida from my home in Atlanta, Georgia, and had gone into business there. And everything was going very, very well. And on a weekend to celebrate a little business venture that had turned out well, I had done what all alcoholics have done or will do. I had celebrated by drinking Friday and Saturday and Sunday. And Sunday morning I woke up sick, nauseated, and I said to my husband at the time, I just don't know what I'm going to do. We're in a new town. We don't know a doctor. He said, you might as well go ahead into the hospital, which had been my pattern. If you don't know what a periodic is, you're looking at one. Clarence says, we're the kind of people who give AA a bad name. He was a chronic. Everybody knew what to expect of him. He was always drunk. Unfortunately, I was the kind that it's hard to know that you're an alcoholic. It's hard to accept the fact. I was sober many weeks, months, years, and didn't know that that drink that I picked up was what ended up with me in the hospital Monday or Tuesday at the latest. So I said to Herb, he said, we better get you in the hospital and get you some IVs and you'll quit vomiting. We don't know anybody. He said, don't worry, I'll find somebody. And I don't know how he picked up a telephone directory and called a doctor that later said to me on a Monday morning, I went into the hospital about 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, and Monday morning he came in bright and early, about 7:30, and he said, Grace, I have two things to tell you today. He said, you are an alcoholic. And I said, my God, what do I do? And he said, oh, that's just very simple. You go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, what's that? And he told me he was an alcoholic. He was 36, 37 years of age. And he sat down on my bed and spent a half an hour telling me what AA was and what it was about. Well, to me, it was tremendous to know that there was something to do about the illness that I had that I didn't know was an illness. He got up to leave, and I said, Doctor, you said you had two things to tell me today. And he dropped right back quickly on the edge of my bed, and he said, I did. Your husband died this morning at 4 o'clock. So I didn't have really alternatives about coming to AA. I was catapulted into AA. I called my young son who was in business with us and told him that my doctor had said I was an alcoholic and that I should go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got out of the hospital, my son said, oh, mother, you can't be one of those people. I said, well, my doctor said I was. Now, I was born and reared in the Deep South, Baptist by background, and I just said to June here, or Marge, or somebody on the front seat, I said, I was raised on the front pew of a Baptist church. And June said, well, Clarence raised me on the front pew of an AA meeting. But when I told my son Yes, but I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, Mother, what are they going to do to you? And I said, I don't have any idea. And I didn't have the foggiest notion on earth what they were going to do or what AA was about. I presume if I had gone to that meeting that night and they had told me I needed to be locked up, I would have gone along with that. Because I had been born and reared in the tradition of respecting my parents, my teachers, my ministers, my attorney, and my doctor. So I had no trouble when he told me that I was an alcoholic. Okay, if that's what he said I was, I was. So my son and I, about the two most frightened people in the world, walked into a meeting in Jacksonville, Florida, to the Arlington Group. And I must say I heard about the worst drunkalogue I have ever heard in my life that night. And I heard those things for 15 long months. One meeting a week, which was an open speakers meeting. We didn't have anything else in that group. And I'd gotten to the place where I seriously doubted if I was what those people standing up on that podium was. If I was what they were. They told about things I didn't know about. Things I'd never done. And I had gone to a young man whose wife had been particularly kind to me. She was an Al-Anon. She is my sponsor today, Catherine Rollerson from Jacksonville, Florida. And I asked Buck, her husband, who was about a year ahead of me in AA, I said, Buck, I'm not crazy. I still have a Cadillac in my garage, and I'm still in business and all, you know, these things you do and say when you're that sick and that new. I said, what about that step that says restores me to sanity? I'm not crazy. And Buck did what for some people might be a fatal thing. And if you're new here tonight, I encourage you to seek somebody that knows more than Buck knew that day. Because Buck told me, Grace, take what of the steps you want and throw the rest out the window. And I proceeded, being a good rummy, to do exactly what he told me. I closed my AA book, and except for reading excerpts out of it at meetings, that's the last time I opened it. And I'll bring you up very quickly until July of 1969. Jack Kiley, a friend of mine in AA, had said to me, we had gotten a little clubhouse out on Jacksonville Beach and had gotten it paid for by hook or crook. And we were going to have a mortgage burning the 26th day of July. And Jack said to me, hey, how would you like to go to dinner with the oldest living man in the world when we have the mortgage burning? Now, this was in February. And I said, oh, that would just be super. And he said, well, Clarence Snyder's going to do our mortgage burning. Well, I had been to the state convention in 68, and I remembered that a tall, bald-headed man stood up and said, you can't walk by light, you must walk by faith. And I wrote it in my big book. Now really, that's the last I remembered or knew or thought about Clarence. And I didn't connect it with what the man Jack was asking me to have dinner with that night. So, I thought I was going to meet a man on two canes with a long beard down to here. And you can imagine my, well, what shall we say? Clarence said, I was so shocked, I didn't know what to say. We got out to the hotel to pick him up. And Jack said, oh, there he is. And I said, that's Clarence Snyder? And he said, yes. I guess I was in shock. I put my head out the window of a car, and I said, Clarence, come over here and give me a kiss. So you see, 26 months later, I became Clarence's wife. But whenever I met Clarence, I was particularly interested to know what this program of AA was all about. And to know what made me so different from the people that I heard tell all of these horrible drunkalogues. And if it was required of me to sit in meetings and hear all of these horrible things that I heard. And he satisfied my mind about that. But I might say, at that time, I became a student. I had been talking all over the East Coast in AA. I was asked to, and I talked. I didn't have any better sense. I didn't know any better. I was ignorant. I'm the first to admit it. When I met Clarence and I found out what the program of AA was all about, and that it was a life-changing program, that you just don't come to this fellowship to get dry and to go back home and stay dry and live for yourself. That AA has been a very deep and a very beautiful and a very, very great commitment for me. He told me it was a life-changing program. And if I took those steps as they are numbered and as they are indicated, that my life would change. Now, you remember I said I was born and reared in a Baptist church in the Deep South. And I thought I was a Christian. I had gotten away from my upbringing in the years that I drank. But when I came to AA, the AA, and learned what the 12 steps of AA meant and were designed to do, I really came back home. I came back just to the kind of a program that I had been nurtured and reared in all of my life. Clarence and I are fortunate enough to do a good bit of traveling around the country. And we have a lot of little groups all over this land of ours and out of this country of ours that are Clarence's kids. These people are not people that are just new stumbling through that door for the first time in AA. They're mostly people who have been in AA for a long period of time, and for some reason unknown to them, they go back out and try it again. They drink, and they don't understand why they drink. And they don't understand. We have a lot of people who are revolving door drinkers. And they come around and say, you know, what do you do? What is different about the program of AA that you have and the program of AA that I have? And the only thing that I can say to you tonight, because I am just introducing your speaker to you, the only thing that I can say that I have differently from anybody in the world in AA that has gone back out and tried it again and still has problem with the program and can't make it, is that my God, as I understand him, has a son whose name is Jesus Christ. And when I totally and completely gave my life to him again and renewed my acquaintance with my God and started to do the things that I had been reared and taught to do all of my life and that I found out this program requires of me to do, I've had the most tremendous life anybody could ever have in the world. Clarence and I will be married 8 years, September the 26th, and I really don't know how I ever lived before. I know today I existed. I really existed. Every day is a great, big, beautiful new day. I can wake up and thank God for a beautiful day. I can thank him for my sobriety. And I can say, this is our day, God. What do you have that you want me to do today? What can I do to serve you better in the capacity that I have? I can imagine that Frank had thought he was going to introduce Clarence tonight. Since Clarence is Frank and June are Clarence's babies in AA. But I really would like to introduce to you the man that I think is the most wonderful man in the entire world. Some of you may disagree with me on that, but then I know him a lot better than you do. I met and married a man that seemed to be a perfect gentleman, seemed to have it together all of the time, never lost his temper, was never angry, nothing was ever out of place and wrong. And I can stand up here with all the truthfulness in the world and tell you tonight that after almost 8 years, he's still that kind of a guy. And he's the most super guy in the world. I'll give you Clarence.
That's the way to train them. Before I get into anything here, can you hear on this thing all right? Here? And a while ago, Jack mentioned about the oldest living member in sobriety as far as women are concerned, and that is Marge Fisher. Will you stand up, Marge? Alcoholics Anonymous. How I got here, that's a miracle. Today, people can walk into AA gathering, any place you want to go, any city, any town, any state, any country, and you'll find Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and Alcoholics Anonymous friends. This wasn't this way when I arrived here. Fact of the matter, how I got here is really something. Only a rummy can do this. I came to a fellowship which did not yet exist. Now, if you can figure that one out, you're coming someplace. I was on the bum. I was married to a gal in those days, a very nice gal. She was the member of a very clannish family. This family did everything together. They invented togetherness. And this family used to have conferences in my home. I was never invited to the conferences for the simple reason I was usually the subject under discussion. The discussions generally went along the line of whether they're going to throw me out of my own home again or let me back in. So this was the way things were going. I was between jobs for several years. And this was in depression time. And I had drank myself out of the line of work that I was experienced and proficient in, and I was blackballed in it. I used to be in the finance and banking business. And I got the best of the bankers, and they never knew how I was doing it. But anyway, I was given my last chance and opportunity to live with this August body, and that was predicated upon the idea that I should go to work for her brother. Now, her brother had a big tractor-trailer outfit, and he hauled merchandise between Cleveland and New York. Cleveland was my hometown. And I was supposed to go to work for him and learn to drive this truck. And, of course, this was a frightening prospect as far as I was concerned for several reasons. First of all, I had never been on one of these trucks, and the idea of learning to drive one of those outfits was quite frightening to me. And the second thing, it suggested hard work. And I've always been against that, and I still am. Well, anyway, to make the bet good, I had to agree to this deal, so away we went. I had a dollar and some change in dimes stuck around my different pockets so they wouldn't rattle. He didn't know I had this capital. And we started one night for New York City. And it was the beginning of winter, and I had no clothes to mount to anything. All my better clothes had been taken care of by Uncle Phil for a small price. And I didn't even have an overcoat. But this outfit he had was a sleeper cab. I was supposed to sleep up in the back of the seat if any sleeping was to be done. He was going to sleep on the seat itself. So we start for New York. And I was scared to death. I looked back out of that window and saw that big 20 tons of stuff following me there, and this was a frightening experience. And I hadn't had a drink that day, and I was sick, and I was shivering, and I was having some pretty bad reactions. And I drove all night in that thing, and the next day he stopped up in New York State for breakfast, which of course I couldn't handle. Then we went on all day the next day till the next evening we wound up in Albany, New York. And finally he conked out. He was tired. He had to take a nap. So he said, he pulled the rig over there to the curbstone. He says, I'm going to take a nap for 3 hours. An okay, I says. Now, this is fine. This is the first opportunity I had to get away from this bird. So I said, this is the capital of New York. I always wanted to see the Capitol buildings. And away I went. I ran down the street. It's funny, you say some of these silly things you remember. I ran down the street, and I got into a place there, but immediately I saw it was too rich for my blood. And I went down a few more blocks and got into a place that is more suitable to a man of my estate. It was a joint. Well, I had enough to start with there to get something in front of me there. And I met an angel. I think he was a fairy, but I'll call him an angel. Because he started to ply me with drinks. And he would put them up about as fast as I could drink them. And this was great. But then things started getting a little stuffy. And I thought it was about time I make my leave there. So I went into the men's room, locked the door, and went out the window, and headed back for this truck. I imagine this guy's still waiting for me. That was about 45 years ago. When I got back to the truck, by that time, I suppose all these drinks hit me at one time because I was not in the best of control. And I started climbing up into my nest, and in so doing, I stepped on this poor boy's face. Well, he came alive with a start, and of course, he knew what was what, and church was out. But he carried me on into New York City, and when we got there, he threw me out on the waterfront. He says, this is the end of the line. Don't ever come back home. You're done. So there I am, 600 miles away from home. I wasn't welcome there, even if I had gone. I had no clothes. I had no money. I only knew one family in the whole greater New York area, and that was another sister of his. But I figured Virginia owed me something, and she really did, if I go into the story, but... So I made my way out to Yonkers, where she lived. I remembered where she lived because we had been there on our honeymoon. As I say, they did everything together in that family. She lived way up on top of a hill. But I didn't go up on a hill. I went down a hill. And I got in the Italian section down there. And this being bootleg days, all Italians had wine. A lot of them made it. Some of them sold it. They all drank it. And some of them shared it with their friends. So I went down there and made friends. By the time I got up to Virginia's house, I was probably a sight for sore eyes. I only remember a couple things about that visit to Virginia's home. I was rolling around on the floor with her two little kids. Little girls, 2 or 3 years old, just babies. And I'm drunk, and I'm dirty, and I smell bad. And she takes a dim view of this procedure. So she put me in the back of her car and took me back down to New York City and threw me out where her brother had thrown me out previously. Well, I'll tell you, I'll never forget that experience of standing on that waterfront alone. I didn't have a nickel to my name. I had no clothes. I didn't know where I was going to stay. I didn't know anything, but I had to exist. I never had such a feeling of aloneness in my life, and I hope I never experience that again. I'm sure I can't now because I have too many friends in AA. But I was completely isolated from everyone at that point in my life. It's something I'll never forget. Well, I had to exist, and I did. I was in New York a long time. I don't know how long. I can't tell you because I wasn't keeping track of time. But I know we went around the calendar at least once because it was winter again when I decided to go back to Cleveland. Well, here's what happened. The reason I tell this long, drawn-out story is it has to do with the miracle of my being here. After I had visited Virginia in Yonkers, sometime shortly afterwards, she had the doctor over. That's when doctors used to make house calls. And the doctor was also a family friend. And they got to talking about drinking, which was a favorite subject in those days, and still is. And she related to this doctor about the occasion of my visit there. I used to be her favorite brother-in-law, a nice guy, but what a dirty, stinking, rotten, drunken bum I am now. And this doctor says, you know, that's odd. He says, I have a brother-in-law who was a lush, and he met some strange cult of people, and since he met this cult, he don't drink anymore, and he runs around New York City chasing drunks, and he brings them home, and he tries to fix them. We used to call it fixing. And he says, and there's another doctor, a medical doctor in Akron, Ohio, a Dr. Robert Smith, who also belongs to this cult, and he spends all of his time chasing drunks in Akron, Ohio, and fixing them down there. He says, now, if your brother-in-law ever gets back to Cleveland, maybe he can meet this doctor in Akron and he can fix him. Well, of course, I don't know this is going on. These people are always doing things behind my back. But anyway, eventually I got the homing instinct, I guess like we all do, and I can remember some trucker took me as far as Erie, Pennsylvania, another one took me into the outskirts of Cleveland where I lived. And it was the middle of winter again, and I lived in a snow belt. The snow was up to my elbows in front of my house. So I charged up on the front porch, and I remember one strange thing. The screen doors were up, and all the screens were up on the windows, and the snow's this deep. And I pounded on the screen door, and Dorothy came to the door, but she did not unhook the screen. And she talked to her wandering boy through the screen. And I was trying to get in the house, naturally, but I wasn't getting along too well here. So I pointed out to her that people just don't leave screens up all winter long, and she needed a man around the house to take care of these little details, using my best salesmanship. Well, she allowed us how she needed a man around the house, but she certainly didn't need one that badly. So I didn't get in. But sometime in the interim, Virginia had written her about this Dr. Smith in Akron, Ohio. So Dorothy told me about this doctor that fixes drunks in Akron. And would I like to go meet him? Well, why not? I could do my business just as well in Akron as in Cleveland. So she put me in her car. These people are always riding me somewhere. And she took me down to the bus depot. She gave me Doc Smith's name and address, and she bought me a one-way ticket to Akron and goodbye. And that's how I met my sponsor. Now, you figure this out, kids. There was no AA then. There was the Oxford movement. Bill Wilson is the one in New York that Dr. Strong was talking about. He happens to be Bill Wilson's brother-in-law. And the doctor in Akron he's talking about is Dr. Bob, the two fellows who are credited with starting the whole ball of wax. And I'm 600 miles from home, and here I am indirectly getting in contact with these two birds. You tell me what this is. Do you think this is any wisdom on my part? This has been strictly nothing but a guidance by my God. It's a miracle. So I met Doc, and he put me in Akron City Hospital. And that's where I was introduced to a program of recovery. Let me tell you something about how I was introduced to this fellowship. I see all kinds of screwy things going on in AA today, and people back off on this and back off on that, and like Grace's sponsor told her, take what you want and throw the rest away. Kids, if you're going to throw it out the window, you better go out the window with it. But here's what happened to me. There was no AA, there was no AA book, there was no literature, there was no nothing. But Doc belonged to the Oxford movement, the Oxford group. So did Bill Wilson. Bill belonged to it in Calvary House at New York, and Doc was attending meetings in T. Henry Williams' home in Akron, Ohio. So while I'm in the hospital, all the men who preceded me in Akron. There were about 14 of them. They came to me to visit me after I was in there a couple of days and got over a lot of my shakes, or got them a little under control. I didn't get over them by a long shot. But they came in and talked to me. And these men impressed me terrifically. They were all older than I was. That's why I'm the oldest one left now, because I've just outlived them. They were all 10, 15, 20 years older than I was. I was only 35 years old then. Life and what had happened to them through booze. These men impressed me. Their example is what did it. The power of example of those men had a profound effect on me. Every afternoon, Doc would come in and visit me, and I was scared to death of this guy. I don't want to go into a long story about why, but I had good reason to be frightened of this fella. And he's my sponsor, but I was scared of him. He's a great, if any of you folks had the pleasure of meeting Doc, and I know some of you have, he was a fella about 6'4", tall, angular fella, and he had fingers on him about this long. I might say that he was a rectal surgeon. I think these fingers must have served him in good stead. But Doc would come in every afternoon, and he'd point these fingers at me, and he'd hit me on the chest with them sometimes for emphasis. I hate a guy that hits you on the chest like this. But I was afraid of this guy, I really was. I didn't know what he was going to do to me. I had no idea. I was looking for an operation. Which I figured that was certainly a new approach. But anyway, Doc came in the last day I was in there. He sat on the foot of my bed as usual. He says, "Well, young fella," he always called me young fella. I was only 35 years old then. Don't count it. Don't take your shoes off. I'll be 77 my next birthday. He sat there and he looked at me and he says, "Well, young fella," he says, "what do you think of all this by now?" I said, "Well, Doc, I think this is wonderful. All these fellas coming in to see me, they don't know me from a load of hay. And they all tell me the story of their life. And they tell me what booze did to them. And I'm puzzled about something." And he says, "What are you puzzled about?" I said, "Every one of those men tells me the same thing. They tell me they have the answer to my drinking problem. And on that note, they leave. They don't tell me anything." I said, "Now, I've been laying around here for about a week. I'm ready to get out of here. What are you going to do to me now? What's next? What's the answer? What are these fellas holding from me? What is this?" Boy, he threw me a curve on that one. He says, "Well, young fellow, we don't know about you. You're pretty young. And we haven't had any luck with these young fellas. They're all screwballs." Well, I wasn't going to argue that point with him. But all these other fellas were 45, 50, and so on up in age. So he says, "You know, we don't know if you're ready yet." My gosh, what do you have to be ready? I weighed 130 pounds. I'd been on the bum for several years. I was unemployable. I had no more home than a rabbit. I had no clothes. I had no money. I had no prospects. I had no nothing. And it's the middle of winter, and I'm a strange town. And he's not ready yet. Well, I guess I finally convinced them. I got scared then that they weren't going to fix me. So I guess I finally convinced them I was ready. He says, "Okay, young fella, I'll give you the answer to this. Gee, now I'm going to get it." So he turns to me and he points that long finger at me and he says, "Young fellow, do you believe in God?" Man, that's the last thing I expect to hear from a doctor. God. I listen to this kind of stuff over in the missions, you know, when you have to get something, you know, you go to a mission, you need clothes, you need something like that, you sing a little bit, you don't have to sing good, but you get what you need. But they tell you all about God, and you tell them everything, you agree with them, they give you what you want. So he says, "Do you believe in God?" Well, I this is the last thing I expect to hear from a doctor, so I have to evade this question. This is a silly question. but you don't evade Doc. So the best thing I can come up with, he says, well, I says, what does that have to do with it? He's a young fella that has everything to do with it. Do you or do you not believe in God? Now I am scared. They're not going to fix me unless I go along with this guy. So I make one more feeble effort to evade him. So I said, well, I guess I do. He says, there's no guessing about it, you do or you don't. Now, I want you to remember, this is the way to handle new people coming in. So I see, now I am frightened. I'm not going to get fixed unless I go along with this bird. So I broke down and said, yeah, I do believe in God. He says, that's fine, now we can get someplace. He says, get down out of that bed. I said, for what? He says, get on your knees. I said, for what? It fooled me too. He says, we're going to pray. I said, who's going to pray? He says, you're going to pray. I says, I don't know anything about praying. He says, I don't suppose you do, but you get down there and I will pray and you can repeat it after me, and that'll do for this time. So he hauls me out of that nice warm nest onto that cold concrete floor in that shorty nightgown on my bare bones, and he uttered a prayer, and I repeated it after him. I don't know what it was, but I have a pretty good idea. It didn't kill me. As you see, I'm still here. But I do remember this. After we concluded this prayer, he shook hands with me, and he says, young fella, you're going to be all right. And that night he carried me to a meeting of the Oxford Group in Akron, Ohio. And this was the biggest shock coming yet. They took me into this beautiful home. T. Henry was a multimillionaire, and he had a beautiful home there, and I walk into this place. I hadn't been in a home like this in many a long day. It had the oriental rugs on the floor and a grand piano in a corner and a lot of oil paintings and these little figurines and bric-a-brac, which I took special note of and filed those away for future reference. And the thing that frightened me mostly, though, when I looked around, saw all those ladies in there. I had met these rummies, and there was a lot of other men in there who were not rummies. You could tell the look at them, they're not rummies. They weren't people at all. You know, the rummies are the only ones that interested me. These were earth people, civilians. And all these ladies, and I can't figure out what they're doing here. But I sat there and watched this performance. And they went on and on with all kinds of things and people jumping up and down and witnessing and one thing another, and some of them would get pretty emotional, carried away and crying and all kinds of business going on. Well, I watched this and I went down there every Wednesday night. I attended those meetings of Oxford Movement for 15 months. But when I left the hospital, Doc Smith told me this. He says, you go back up to Cleveland and you'll spend the rest of your life fixing rummies as an avocation for free. That's your ministry. So I went back up to Cleveland. Now you picture this, kids. There was no AA book. There was no AA group. There was no nothing. I'm alone in Cleveland, Ohio. Cuyahoga County, 1.25 million people. Old Cooney knows about this. He came from up that neck of the woods. But there was no shortage of rummies. And my job was to go up there and fix all the rummies in Cuyahoga County. And you know, I felt I'd never really be a real member of this bunch of rummies in Akron until I'd sponsored somebody. So what did I do? Now, you picture this deal. I had nothing to show anyone. There was no group. We had no history. We had no background. We had no book. We had no nothing. So I start going down the street. I went to the places where rummies hung out. I went to the Associated Charities. I went to the police. I went to the clergy people. I went every place where rummies were. And I went into joints and tackled them. And I'd walk right in and tackle some rummy and tell him he ought to quit drinking. He ought to be like me. You can imagine the reception. You don't know what abuse is, and some of it was physical. Well, do you know what? Now remember, there's depression on in those days, too. I talked to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of assorted rummies, dipsomaniacs, drunks, what have you, alcoholics. It took me 7 long months before I cracked my first one, before I got my first baby in the hospital. I will never forget that experience if I live to be 1,000 years old, because it did something to me and for me. I never figured I'd be a real Indian and win my feather till I'd sponsored somebody successfully. And here this guy, I'll never forget this fella. Believe me, I know he has to be in heaven now because of what he did for me, unbeknownst to him. If you folks can remember, some of you old enough to remember the Depression, a lot of people lost their homes, and they just vacated them and left, and they doubled up with other people. And some of those empty houses, these rummies who were on the move, there's a lot of men just wandering around the country. They had no homes, remember that. And I was way over on Fleet Avenue, you know where that is, way over in the Polish section over there, Bohemian section. And I went into one of these houses, and there's probably 15 or 20 rummies lying around in various conditions. Some of them are up and some of them are down. Some of them are passed out. Some of them are walking around. And there they are. They're in there to keep out of the weather. They just take squatter's rights in his home, some of them did. And I see this big fella lying right on the floor there. Well, he's lying there and he can't move. You heard people being dead drunk? This guy was paralyzed drunk. But he knew everything I was doing and saying. I got down on the floor with him, talked to this guy. His name was Bill Hess. He's a Polish fella. He had been an auditor for Sherwin-Williams Paint Company for years, and they fired him out, and he hadn't seen his family in years. And he was lying there on that floor, and I got down with him, and I asked him if he'd like to quit drinking for good. And he was all for the idea. This is the first guy that I ever met to give me any encouragement after all those hundreds of people. So, I asked him the next silly question. Could you get a hold of any dough? $50. I'll get you in a dry out place and get you sobered up. I might as well ask him for $50,000 to just be as close. He says, no, but my mother lives in Madison, Ohio, which is about 55 miles east of Cleveland. And if you go see her, I know that she has money, and if she knows that you found me, she'll give you anything if she knows that you're going to help me. So with that, I head for Madison, Ohio. I'll never forget that, because I know when it was, and this is why I know it took me 7 months. This was the first day of hunting season. And his home where his mother lived was a farm. It lived way down a lane. And I was afraid to drive the car down there because I was afraid I might get stuck. It was kind of mucky back there. So I left the car on the road and started walking down this long lane. And I heard all these guns going off. Boom, 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 all over the place. And boy, a frightening thought came to me. This is the beginning of hunting season. These are probably some of Bill's pals or relatives, and they're probably all jugheads, and they're running around here shooting at everything that moves. But I kept on, I had to make a decision whether to keep on going to the house or go back to the car and let the whole thing go down the drain. But I went back up to the house. I rap on the door, and this little old lady comes to the door, and Bill forgot to tell me one very important little detail. He forgot this. His mother was Polish, and she don't know one word of English. I get up there. I only know 2 words of Polish. Jak się masz, dobrze. And you can only yakshi, marsh, and dubshe so long you run out of conversation. But there's a little kid there, about 7 or 8 years old, who's a grandchild, I presume. And through him as an interpreter, I talked this old gal out. I told her I'd met it, found her boy, and I needed $50 to fix him. And do you know, this is the time that all the banks were closed and everything else. You remember that depression? People, if they had any money, they had it in little tin cans buried out in the yard. You see little mounds out in the yard. Or they had it in a sugar bowl, or they had it in a mattress or something. So she apparently went in and cut a lump out of the mattress. And she brought me out 50 of these great big bills. I bet a lot of you people have never seen those old bills that they had. Man, I had arrived. And I headed back for Cleveland. And I got back there, and Bill's still lying where I left him. So I called Doc. I was coming to Akron with a baby and be ready to meet me at the Akron City Hospital. I got some of those jugheads to help me lift Bill and carry him out and put him in the car, threw him in the back of the car, and away I went. I had arrived. I had sponsored someone. That was my first baby. After that, they seemed to come real fast. Now, I know now why it took me 7 months to get my first baby. And I know why, right immediately after it, a whole bunch start coming. After that, they seem to come real fast. Now, I know now why it took me 7 months to get my first baby. And I know why, right immediately after it, a whole bunch start coming. It says something in our 5th chapter about carrying a message. I just didn't have a message. I had a lot of steam, a lot of brass, a lot of gall, a lot of ego, and what have you, and a lot of time. But I had no message. It took me 7 months to get that message that I finally put across to Bill Hess. Then immediately, a whole flock of Irishmen came in. Holy smokes. What would we do without the Irish? I always say this is an Irish disease that's cured in Methodist church basements. Had another Irishman shortly after that, and Cooney knows him. I think he's a relative of his. Al Goldrick. And Al was I chased that guy all winter long, and finally landed him into City Hospital in Akron. We were having trouble in the Oxford movement. The rummies were having trouble with the civilians. The book was written in the fall of 1938, and this is in May 1939. Al Goldrick was in the hospital there, and we were trying to fix him. They were talking, he was getting the same treatment I was getting. But here's what happened. Out of the first 14 men that we got in Cleveland, half of them were Roman Catholics. The Oxford group was a religious group, and it was a Protestant situation. And they went through all kinds of things that the Catholic Church would not stand still for. So the Catholics didn't feel they could belong to this Oxford group, which caused us a great problem. So I went down to see my sponsor, Doc Smith, about it, and I explained to him what we were up against. I says, Doc, you know, these fellows can't come. I says, they can't belong to an Oxford group. I says, we don't need all this falder all over the Oxford group. We can eliminate a lot of this stuff. We have a book now with 12 steps, and we have the four absolutes, and anyone can live with that. He says, well, you can't do that. He says, you can't break this thing up. I said, we're not breaking anything up. All I'm interested in is something with more universality to it, so anybody can belong, whether they have religion or believe in anything or not. They can come. He says, well, you can't do that. I says, we're going to do something. And he says, like what? I says, well, we'll see like what. Now, this is my break with my sponsor. I'm 15 months sober, and I'm telling my sponsor all about it, which I don't know why I waited that long.
People today don't do that. They start right off the first meeting. Well, anyway, I went out to see Al's wife. They had a big home. Al had a big home on the Heights. Al was a lawyer. He was getting kicked out of his law firm at the time. He was about to lose his home, too. But he saved the whole thing. The whole thing was salvaged. So I talked to his wife, Grace, about using their home for a meeting place. We didn't know anything about meeting halls. We didn't have any money anyway. So she was delighted with the idea of having a meeting in her home. So I went down to Akron the next Wednesday night and made this announcement, and here's how the split came, and here's how AA started as AA. The book had come out in February of 39, and this is May of 39, 3 months later. I went down to the meeting in Akron, says this is the last time the Cleveland contingent will be down here as a group. We are going to start our own group in Cleveland, Ohio, and I made the mistake of giving them the address at 2345 Stillman Road, Cleveland Heights. I shouldn't have done that. And I says, this is not going to be an Oxford group. It's going to be known as Alcoholics Anonymous. We're taking the name from the book, and only alcoholics and their families are welcome, nobody else. Well, you figure this out. We were a minority group. We, the alcoholics, were most of these people, were civilians in this outfit. And here we are, breaking away from them. Well, to say the least, it was a riot. The roof came off the house. Clarence, you can't do this. It's done. You must come down and talk about it. There's nothing to talk about. Well, if I thought that was a riot there in Akron that night, I wish you'd have seen it 2345 Stillman Road the next week on Thursday night. That whole group descended upon us and tried to break up our meeting. One guy was going to whip me. Now, I know. I want you to know this is all done in pure Christian love. But we stood our ground, and that's how AA started. AA started in a riot. It grows in riots. Some donkey put something in about unity here. If we ever had unity, you know what would happen? We'd have one great big group with about five people doing all the work and the rest of them getting drunk. We are the proponents of disunity. Nobody ever goes out and starts a group because we need a group. Somebody gets mad at somebody. And we choose up sides. If we stay together, we'll kill each other. We get apart and everybody does all right. So I saw the first AA group. Now there's probably 30-some thousand of them around the world. I looked at that group one night at Al Goldrick's house, and I said to myself, I still remember this. I said, boy, if we ever had as many as 35 members, wouldn't this be some group, you know? It wasn't 2 years, we had 35 groups already, see? 35 groups, and I mean, it wasn't groups like you see today, the same people go in every group. They were identified. They had their own identity. They had their own officers. So different people. Yeah, other people go and visit these groups, but there was actually 35 groups. And from that point on, I don't know how many hundreds they got up there now. But it's the same in all big cities and all small cities. Now, AA started as a gift of God. Let me tell you something. Why do people walk into this fellowship and they've been drunk X number of years, they've been doing all this trouble, they've been in jail, they've been kicked out of jail, they've been in nut houses, they've lost jobs, they've lost families, they've lost all their resources, they've lost their sanity, they've lost their direction completely. And they walk through the door of this AA meeting and bingo! They get sober and stay that way. Why? Why does this? Let me tell you something about alcoholism. Alcoholism is probably the oldest malady that afflicts the human race. You read about alcoholism in ancient history. You read about it in mythology. You read about it in the Bible. There's some awful good rummy stories in the Bible.
You don't have to go any further than the first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis, and you meet your first rummy, your first drunk. Meet our friend Noah. He was one of us. You read that story, and you'll know that he's one of us. Well, you figure this out. Here's this guy. Noah was a God-fearing man. And the world got itself into about the kind of a shape it's in now. Everything going down the pits. Everybody going to hell in a basket, you know? Everything. And values and everything gone. Everybody doing as their doggone please. The devil with tomorrow or today. So God decided he's going to wipe the whole thing out and start all over again. He don't see any way he's going to change them. So he gets his friend Noah. He says, Noah, my boy, he says, I want you to do something for me. He says, anything, Lord. He says, I want you to build a big boat. And he gave him the dimensions of this thing. And he says, when you get this built, he says, I want you to put two of everything living in there and your family. He said, Noah says, why? He said, I'm going to destroy this whole world and I need seed to start again. And your family will be seed and these living creatures that you take in there will be the seed to start a new situation. Okay, I'll do it, Lord. So Noah and his family get out there cutting wood and pounding it, making this big boat, and the neighbors come by and they say, what are you doing, Noah? Building a boat. He said, a boat out here in the middle of the desert? You know, you've got to be gone. You've got to be gone. He says, sure. He says, why? He says, the world's going to be flooded. Everything's going to be destroyed. Well, then they know he's nuts, you know. And they laugh at him, but he keeps on pounding away and builds the boat. Finally, it gets built, and sure enough, he fills it up as God had ordained that he should do. And boy, it started to rain. And it rained and rained and rained, and it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. And that old boat came up, 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 starts to floating around for several months. Finally, the water started to recede, and that boat landed on Mount Ararat. And the water went down, and there's the land. What was the first thing our friend Noah did? Our friend Noah. He ran up there, he planted a vineyard, he raised some grapes, he made some wine, and he got drunk. Read the story. Yeah, the first rummy in the Bible. You want to hear a couple more rummy stories in the Bible? Tell you a couple anyway if you want to hear them or not. I like that story of the Jericho Road. The Good Samaritan. Here's a rummy story, and everybody in it's a rummy. Picture this. Here's this fella lying out on the side of the road, stripped naked, all beat up and half dead. He don't have a stitch of clothing on him. Everything gone. Okay? What do you think happened to that guy? He got drunk and he got rolled. I don't suppose any of you ever got rolled, but he did. He's lying out there. So here's what happens. This priest comes along and he sees him lying there. And he's a man of the world. He's seen rummies rolled before. And he looks at this bird. And he says, good enough for him, the dirty, stinking, drunken bum. He got himself in that shape. Let him get himself out of it as best he can. So he crosses on the other side of the road and leaves that rummy lying there in his misery. Then along come this next fella, the Levite. And he sees this fella, and he's also a man of the world. Same thing. He says the same thing that the priest said. And it's the same thing we hear today. Don't you ever kid yourself you don't hear it. It's still, it's been ingrown in the priest. That's been handed down for generations. So he crosses on the other side of the road. He isn't going to bother with that dirty, stinking, drunken bum. So then comes this Samaritan guy. Well, the Samaritans were not the chosen people there at the time. And he's a traveling salesman. I'll prove that to you. And he's making this territory. So he comes along on his former conveyance. I'm sure it wasn't a Chevrolet. It was probably a mule. And he sees this fellow lying there, and he's a man of the world, too. He's a rummy. And he recognizes the earmarks immediately.
So what did he do? Did he pass him by?
Nope.
He got down off of his form of conveyance and he ministered to him. And what does it say he did? He gave him a drink.
Just the medicine he needed.
He gave him wine. See? Well, did he leave him lie there?
Nope.
He picked him up and he put him on his form of conveyance and he took him to the Holiday Inn.
Or the inn.
And here's how I know they're all rummies. He says, Mr. Innkeeper, take care of this fellow. Here is some money. You see, he handed the money to the innkeeper, not the rummy. He says, and here's how I know he's a salesman making the territory. He says, if there be any more due, I will repay you on my next trip. So you see, he picked him up. That's the first 12-step call on record. It's in the Bible. Boy, I'm telling you. Stories. I love that story of the two boys, the prodigal son. This is a terrific story. Get this one. Here's these two boys. They're Jewish kids. And the old man has a big spread. So, of course, when the father dies, all the loot is going to be divided between the two sons. So these two boys are helping the father run this farm. He has everything on there. He's got cows and sheep and goats, no hogs, but everything else. He has his whole thing all set up. And these kids are working there. And this one kid, the older kid, boy, he's a busy guy. He does more than his father ever expects him to do. He's a busy one. He's the Al-Anon kid. But the other, the young one, guess who? He can't wait till some indefinite time when his father dies. He wants his right now when he's young and can enjoy it. So he keeps bugging his father and bugging his father and bugging his father for his share of the loot. And finally the father can't take it anymore. He says, okay, take your share and be gone. And boy, that kid was be gone too. And what does it say happened? It says he went into a far country and he squandered his substance in riotous living. Did you ever hear of a thing like that? He blew the whole bundle. He's tapped out, he's flat, and that isn't the worst yet. A famine set in and he can't get anything to eat and he's a stranger in a far country. And he's in a pickle, this guy. So he's trying to survive like I did when I was on the waterfront in New York. I can always remember this fella for my own experience. So what does he do? Do you know what kind of a job he got? The only thing he got a job on a hog farm taking care of a bunch of hogs. Remember, this kid's a Jew. Did he eat what the hogs ate? No, it's not on your life. The Bible says he ate of the husks of the hogs. He ate what the hogs left over and wouldn't eat. That's what he got. I'd say this kid pretty well hit his bottom, wouldn't you? He was on his way. Something important happened. And here's what has happened. It says he came to himself. This is what we had to do. He came to himself. He says, my father has much. His servants have much. They eat well. They live well. See? And I starve. Here's the next thing he says, and this is what we had to do too. He says, I will arise and go to my father and tell him I am unworthy. See? I will throw myself upon his mercy. So this kid starts that long, that painful trip way back from that far country back home. And what happened? Did his father chew him out? Nope, says in the Bible. That his father saw him coming afar off. And he ran to him and fell on his neck and kissed him. He says, my son who is dead is alive. He says, let us make merry. Let's have a feast. Let's have food. Let's have dancing. Let's have music. So, boy, they have a blast up there. They're having a great old time up there at the house.
They're eating and drinking. He says, put a cloak on his back, a ring on his finger, shoes on his feet. My son who is dead is alive. Let us make merry. So they're making merry, boy. Meanwhile, this Al-Anon kid, he's out there still working away. Like a good Al-Anon should. And he hears all this ruckus up at the house. And a servant came by. He said, hey, what's all that ruckus up at the house? That music and stuff. He says, haven't you heard? He says, no, what? He says, your brother came home. He says, oi, that dirty no good. See? So at that, he drops his tools and went up to the house to confront his father. Now, this is the very human thing. Very human. He goes to his father, he says, father, I have always been a good son to you, dutiful, done what you ask and more. This dirty, stinking brother of mine took his inheritance and blew it on riotous living. He comes home and you have a party for him. He said, you never had a party for me, father. Father had to explain why. This is a great story of the second chance, the forgiveness. See? Well, there's rummies in the Bible. I can give you more, but I'm not going to talk any more about those. There they are. This has been going on a long time. Why do we walk into here and recover from a hopeless situation? Alcoholism, as I said, is probably the oldest malady that afflicts the human race. All down through these centuries, the alcoholic has only had two options. He can go crazy or die or both. About 40 years ago, when this program was put together and started as Alcoholics Anonymous, the alcoholic got a third option. He can go crazy, he can die, or he can get well. This never happened before. Never. You and I are the blessed ones. We're blessed with this opportunity of life and real life, wonderful life. We don't have to live that anymore. We don't have to exist that way anymore. There's a change. Now, if I could tell you about the problems that we had to cope with in those early days, everyone had that same idea that those people did about the Good Samaritan, that guy laying out in the alcoholic is a no-good SOB, and he's less than human. This has been handed down from generation to generation. People have been conditioned to believe this. So they run around yet today. I heard about one of them today here, one of you in your group, a wife of one of the boys here. So scared to let anybody know this guy belongs to AA. That's pitiful. That's pitiful. What kind of a crazy, foolish pride is that? You know, I'm not anonymous. I never have been, and I never will be. I don't think that's our function to hide from people. And I don't think it's our function to hide from each other. I want to know who my friends are. I want to know your name. If I see notes hanging on club rooms, Joe P. is in Mound Park Hospital. Who in the hell is Joe P.? How am I going to send Joe P. a card or go to see him? There's probably 44 of them in the hospital, see? I want you to know me, and I want to know you. I'm not ashamed of my membership here. I am proud of it. I was one time very ashamed of myself and for people to know what I was and so forth. No longer do I have to hide from anybody. I had all those fears years ago. I have them no more. I get an awful lot of criticism. I've had it for years because of my lack of what some people call anonymity. You know what anonymity means to me? It means just this. I don't care who in the world knows I am an AA. I never did. You have my permission to tell anybody that Clarence Snyder is a member of AA. But I have no right to go out and tell anybody that you do without your permission.
That's all it means. This is not a secret society where we hide from each other and everybody else. How do you think this thing ever started? How do you think it ever got going? Somebody had to go out and put their chin out. Somebody had to go out and talk to all these people who had something to do with alcoholics. We had to establish hospitals. We had to establish dry out places. We had to establish meetings, groups. We had to talk to people and get some support. Now we got a wonderful press. Gee, you find something about AA in the newspapers, magazines, funny papers, movies, everything is in there. Why hide? Don't hide. Why should you hide? You're wrong if you do. I'll tell you why you're wrong. You and I are the only people who have the gift and the talent for fixing rummies. All these thousands of years, a lot of people have tried. Smarter people than you and I. Their scorecard's not so hot. But there isn't an alcoholic sitting in this room that doesn't have a talent to go out and help another person change his entire life and give him a life. This is what we have here. We should value this. We shouldn't hide it. It's ridiculous. Now, tell me something. Why do people come in here? Let me say something about alcoholism and alcoholics. You know, everyone can't be an alcoholic, really. That's a privilege reserved for a chosen few. I don't think that over 7 or 8% of the population can be an alcoholic. They're just not made that way. Alcoholics are different than people. Really, really. There are a lot of drunks. Every alcoholic is a drunk, but every drunk is not an alcoholic. I've met a lot of drunks that don't have sense enough to be an alcoholic. It's the truth. They're stupid. Alcoholics are not stupid. They're anything but. Alcoholics are a class all by themselves, and you should be proud that you are one. I'll tell you why. To be an alcoholic, I'm not talking about a stupid drunk, I'm talking about an alcoholic. You have certain characteristics. I can tell an alcoholic by looking at him. I don't have to smell him. Really. I made this remark a week or so ago. Grace and I were down in the Cayman Islands, down in British West Indies. We were asked to come down there and try to help them do something about their Alcoholics Anonymous, which has just been around there for 5 years and nobody doing anything. And while down there, I talked to a lot of people, all the service clubs. But one talk I made was to the police department. They brought every one of those policemen in there for this meeting in the afternoon, men police and women police. And I start talking about it, and I've made this same statement. I says, I can tell an alcoholic to look at him. Yeah? So one of the women cops says to me, can you tell me the alcoholics are sitting in here? I says, yes, I can. She says, tell me. I says, I can't do that publicly, but I'll see you afterward, and I'll show you some of them in here that are rummies. So on the way out, she sidled up to me. I says, see that one there? Yeah, she says, he's one. Yeah. He's that, and your chief, too. Yeah, he is. Even the governor. You know, I'll bet this has happened to you. It's happened to me many times. I'll be walking down a street, and some panhandler's coming down 2 blocks down the street, and he'll pass 15 people and he'll put the arm on me. Why? A brother under the skin. He knows me. He don't smell me. He feels me. This is right. Let me tell you what the alcoholic's made of. To be an alcoholic, you have to be something special. You do. Believe me. I've never met an alcoholic worthy of the name who is not a high-strung individual. Very high-strung. He's very impulsive. He don't do any, you know, he's not a deep thinker. You never find an alcoholic
thinking. If he thinks, he gets in trouble.
He don't think. He emotes. He feels. That's why you can't... No alcoholic's going to accept this program till he hurts. You can do all the talk, all the damn common sense you want in the world to him. He's not going to do any good. But when he hurts enough, he'll take this program. See? So, he's not a deep thinker, but he's a quick one. He's got a wealth of imagination and ingenuity. He'll out-lie anybody in the world. He's the biggest liar that ever wore shoes. He's lonely and he's sensitive. Very sensitive soul. He's always running around looking to tell me their problems, and I understand them. They need a program to salvage the best people they have in their employ. The alcoholic is something special, so don't ever apologize for being an alcoholic. And don't ever deny it. Be proud. You have something that other people don't have. You got a talent that other people don't have, and you better use it. Because it says, tells me in a good book that we use the talent. If we don't use our talent, we lose it. If you don't believe that, read the parable of the talents in the Bible. Find out what happened to the guy that didn't use his one talent. Took it away from him, threw him out. We have this talent. You and I have responsibility. The alcoholic can operate on probably 40% of his efficiency and compete and beat other people that are operating on 80% of theirs. I can tell you what I did in my own experience. I don't want to go into it, but I took a job after I'd been fired off the first one that I'd had for 9 years. They gave me an executive job in a company that I had to build a department. And I was drunk the day they hired me. I was drunk every night for 3.5 years that I worked for that bunch. And I did them a terrific job. And when they finally had to fire me, they had to hire 13 people to take my place. No kidding. Hell, I never let them know what I was doing. We are slick. We're connivers. Well... Funny thing, when they finally had to let me go, they gave me a going-away party. I got fired and they have a going-away party. This is a rummy for you. Well, anyway, what is alcoholism? I told you what an alcoholic is. He's different than people. Great person. What's alcoholism? Most people talk about alcoholism as being a matter of taste. They say, boy... That guy must love his liquor. He drinks 2 or 3 quarts a day. Actually, I have met very few alcoholics that like to taste the booze. And if you don't believe that, get on the bum like I was, and you'll drink anything. I paid 7 cents a pint for my booze, and I bought it in a wallpaper store. I always had 2-gallon jugs of it, too. If you think I drank that stuff because of its palatable virtues, try it sometime. Turn you inside out. And other people talk about it being a habit. It's not a habit. We're all creatures of habit. We do most of the things in daily life by force of habit. Habit saves a lot of wear and tear on the brains. But this is... Sure. Get up in the morning. What do you do in the morning? Go through the same old routine. You're half awake. You take your shower and put your right sock on first and your left and on. The only thing you have to think about getting dressed is if you're going to have a purple tie with a yellow suit or something, you know. Figure out your color scheme. That's about it. Then you take the bus or get your car and go to work and go through the same bloody routine day after day. Habit, 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 habit. See? If this were a habit... We would have taken care of this a long time ago. Because any habit we have, we can break. With a little suffering and a little guts. This habit of smoking that most alcoholics carry on to excess. If a doctor came along and told you you didn't quit smoking, you'd be dead in 30 days. There isn't a monkey in here that wouldn't quit in 3 days. It would hurt. But we do it.
So it's not a matter of taste, it's not a matter of habit. Drinking to an alcoholic is something entirely different. It's an obsession. It's a way of life. It's a drive. When I was a drinking alcoholic, this is when I was still able to associate with decent company and operate in business. Whenever I was invited to something, no matter what, if I was going to a picnic, I was going to a ball game, I was going to a show, I was going to a business conference or a funeral or a wedding or what have you, first thing I had to consider was a liquor situation. Is there going to be booze there? How much and how quick can I get it? No booze, no Clarence. Very simple life. But if I had to go someplace at a respectable party and expect to suck on a highball all night long, I would go there half knockered and take my own jug with me and ditch it somewhere and steal all my host liquor I get my hands on. I did this when I was still in respectable company. What do you call that? Something wrong up here. I had an obsession. There was a drive that I couldn't overcome. Now, to overcome an obsession is a lot different than overcome a habit or a taste situation. This taste thing would be the easiest thing, you know. Who wants to, I could cultivate a taste for something else, like apples or bananas. I don't know who wants to eat 40 bananas a day, but... So, it's an obsession. The only way I know to overcome is an obsession. The only way I know is to change the whole pattern of my life. Where once upon a time the idea of a drink was the most important thing in my life, I had to change that where the idea of a drink is the most ridiculous thing in my life. How do I do this? I'm not able to do it by myself. So, I'm introduced to a program. Let me tell you what this program is. When I came here, we didn't have this 12-step program. We had a 6-step program in the Oxford movement, and all of that 6-step program was taken from the Sermon on the Mount and the Book of James. So that's where your 12-step program comes from, too. So somebody gets yapping about it. There's the source of our program. So we have no copyright on it. Nobody has a copyright on the Sermon on the Mount. Okay, we can all use it. So this program, 6 steps, was designed to change my life. They called it a life-changing program. When the book was written, we took those 6 steps and made 12 steps out of them. We figured if alcoholics could screw up 6 steps, they could screw up 12 much easier. And they do. So here we are. Let's go into this program. I want to tell you what it means to me. And how this program, what it really means to you. And how to accept it and how to use it and how to profit from it. Our program is divided in 4 phases. The first phase is the first step. The phase of admittance. It says in that first step, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. Hey, I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. Well, that's quite an admission. 2 things. I'm powerless and my life is unmanageable. Well, if I can't manage my life, I better hire a manager. Isn't that simple enough? I can't do it, so I hire a manager. So the second phase of this program is the 2nd through 7th steps. And this is a phase of submission, where I submit my will and my life to the care of my new manager, whom I call God. Right here, I want to say one thing, just for the benefit of a lot of people that are always straining at gnats and swallowing camels. There's only one God that I believe in. Some guy will say, well, what about all these guys that believe in Mohammed and believe in Zen and all? Honey, they got dead ones. I got a live God. If they want a dead God, that's too tough. I don't want them. I want a live one who I can communicate with. So the second through the seventh step is submission, where I submit my will and my life to the care of my new manager. Second step says, I came to believe. It didn't say I believed that when I got here, not by a long shot. It says, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. You hear a lot of people start to squawk. You say, I'm not nuts. Well, listen, kids, if you're not nuts, you don't belong here. This is the greatest collection of nuts in the world. So this is the first qualification. You got to be nuts. If you don't think you're nuts, just look back on some of the things you did when you were drunk. Ask yourself, are those the addicts of a sane person? I don't have to say any more about that. Be glad you're nuts, because it got you here. So, all right. Third step says, I made a decision. Now, that in itself is something for a rummy to do. We are the most indecisive people in the world. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of my new manager. How do you like that? I'm going to turn my will and life over to the care of this ethereal creature way out in the blue yonder, who's way out in that outer space, who I've been running away from for years and scared to death of. Not on your life, kids, unless I hurt real badly. See? See how I talk? It's not common sense. It's emotion. It's how I feel. I do everything on feeling. If I hurt badly enough, I'll do that. If I don't, I won't. That's where I stop right now. There's where where people in AA get their first and their fatal stumble is in step three. They try to hold reservations. He says, okay, but, well, I'm an atheist. I'm an agnostic. Horse feathers. I get this crap all the time. It says something in our fifth chapter. If you want to come into this fellowship, there's a qualification. It says very plainly in the fifth chapter, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you are now ready to take certain steps. If you don't qualify for that, what are you doing here? That's the qualification. Alcoholics, one characteristic of the alcoholic is this, and it's so important. We are all extremists. We never do anything by halfway measures. When an alcoholic works, he works hard, he plays hard. When he gets drunk, he makes a career out of it. And believe me, when we want to recover, it has to be with the same verve. Right. Because we are extremists. There's no halfway measures in our recovery either. That's why so many people have such a miserable time when they come to AA. They don't want to go the whole way. So they make reservations on step three. I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to my new manager. The fourth step, if I'm going into business with a new manager, I better find out what I have to work with. Do I have any stock in trade if I'm going in business with a new manager? So it says I made a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. I don't think there's an alcoholic worthy of the name who has the capacity to take that step by himself. And it's one of the most misunderstood steps we have. A lot of people think that means you have to sit down and write about all the dirty, stinking, rotten things you've done in your life. And that is not what that step calls for at all. In fact, the matter is, I can't remember a lot of the dirty, stinking things I did, and I'm glad I can't. Some of them are a matter of record, but I don't remember them. But that means, what do I have going for me morally, and what am I lacking? What about my lie? Do I lie? Do I cheat? Do I do this? Do I do that? Do I gossip? Do I go all these, am I a double dealer? All these different lousy, stinking things that we do. These are the things we have to put down, and then what good things do I have in me? I've got to have something going for me. The very fact that I came here in the first place means I want to do something for myself, so that's in my favor at least. I may not have too many good things going for me, but I'll cultivate some as time goes on. So will you. So the fifth step tells you this. that there was someone, as I said, I don't think any alcoholic should ever try that fourth step by himself, but the fifth step says he shouldn't. It says we admit it to God, that's my new manager, myself, and to another human being. What do I admit to myself and God and another human being? The exact nature of my wrongs, not the wrongs themselves, the nature of them. See? Okay. All right. Step six says we were entirely ready. Now get that, entirely. An alcoholic is entirely in everything he does, being an extremist. So I'm entirely ready for what? Me to remove these? No, I can't do it. I admit it, I can't. For my manager to do it. I'm entirely ready to have my manager remove all these defects of character. All of them, it says. All of them. Did you get that? I'm very frank to admit there's some defects of character I'd like to keep. They're fun things. But the program does not give me that prerogative or that privilege. It's all or nothing at all if I want to get the best out of this, and I'm out for everything. Being an extremist, I'll tell you what kind of a nut I am. And I'm no different than you, only maybe you have never wakened up to this, some of you. I'm an extremist. Some people are satisfied with crumbs. I'm not. I want that cake. See that cake there? That's what I want. I want cake. When Grace makes me a cake, it's a layer cake, and she puts great big whipped cream and stuff in between each layer and on top and all over it, see? Not only does she do that, but I want something else on there. I want a cherry on top of it yet, see? I want the whole thing, and I get it. You ask her, she'll tell you. I want that in my life, too. I want the whole thing. I'm a pig for it. So I want the best. It only costs a buck more to go first class. So why take second class or third class? Or why take crumbs when you can have the whole cake? And the whole cake's here for every one of us. All right. Says I'm entirely ready to have him remove all these defects of character, and then I humbly asked him to remove my shortcomings. I humbly asked him. I didn't make any deal with him. I just asked him. The good book tells me that anything I ask him, believing, I will receive. I shall receive it. And I believe that. And I've lived long enough to see the truth of that statement in my own experience and other people's experience. So all I do is ask my manager to do this, and he does it. We work together. I'm unable to do these things, so he's helping me. That's the last of the second phase. The third phase is the phase of restitution. That's the eighth and ninth steps, where we made a list of all persons we'd harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. That's what's important in that step, the willingness to make amends to everyone.